Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. This is John Anderson with NASCA. Oh, and also want to welcome Penelope Menace and Kim Lakin for joining me today. NASCA has a wonderful, wonderful guest tonight. Matt Packness, he is from Marion, Massachusetts, and he is a father, along with most everybody that we have on the show. And I'm going to bring Matt on in just a few minutes. Before this, I want to tell you a little bit about NASCA and what we do. Well, NASCA is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And Bill Murray, who is our president, has done such a wonderful job with founding this organization. And you can also catch us on the web at NASCA.org. And you can also listen through your cell phone through NASCA_mobile.org. So here at NASCA, we basically, I guess, thrive on three things here, and that's prevention, intervention, and recovery, okay? And with that, we have a single purpose at NASCA, and that's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violence, and or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. And the first goal, which is exactly what we're doing tonight and every single night, educating the public. Okay, so educating the public to me is has to be on an upper level where the platforms need to be unlimited, and this is what NASCA is all about, especially related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, preventing facts and showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone, okay? And that is the truth. It affects everyone. So, you know, the second is offering hope and healing, okay, through numerous paths. I mean, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And when you come onto the website, there is a whole list of programs available through NASCA. We have news, articles, and stats available, and we have all about recovery and protecting our kids, and you can participate, okay, in the NASCA show. So our call-in number is area code 646-595-2118. And I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight on this Wednesday. And without any further ado, I'm going to introduce our guest in just a minute. His name is Matt Packness, okay? And like I said, he's from Marion, Massachusetts, a survivor of child abuse when he was only 9, okay? And just he's a senior management consultant with 6 years of college football coaching, 10 years of playing. So we have another fellow athlete here, along with myself, and hopefully several people that are listening today can actually, you know, comprehend what it's like to be an athlete to go through this. And he's got 5 championship seasons, you know, and focus on is lessening of bullying in the workplace, okay? So we're going to be talking about all these issues tonight. And also, look, he was a former assistant coach with a well-known university, Penn State, under Joe Paterno, who we know about them. I mean, you know, what a great career Coach Joe had over there. And plus, you know, he has spoken publicly about, you know, his child abuse, okay? And so when Matt was 9, you know, his mom was diagnosed with melanoma, okay? So we always like to break it off at a point. And I think before, you know, I go on to any other further information about Matt, is that I'd like, you know, for him to tell his story to you tonight, okay? So, you know, he's going to tell you everything. This is his night. So if you do want to call in, please, you know, keep your comments and your questions to as short as we can. So, you know, we make sure that Matt has enough time to speak with everything he wants to speak, because he's got some good news to share at the end. I can guarantee that. So, you know, without any further ado, I do want to bring on our special guest, Mr. Matt Packness. Hello, Matt.
Hi, John.
Hello, Matt. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
okay?
Hi. Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure can. Well, man, thank you so much for being here tonight. I can't thank you enough, man. Any time that we can get somebody like you on the show, you know, to tell us everything that can help out with anything that we do, because we have so much in common here at NASCA with what you went through, you know.
Uh-huh.
And and just having you on tonight means a lot to us. It really does. So I want to thank you from everybody at NASCA for being here tonight. Okay.
Well, thank you. It's an honor.
Great, great. Well, how you feeling, man? You feel a little nervous? Have you been on a scale this large before?
Well,
I know you.
Yeah, I've been on. You mentioned. Well, first, I want to clarify something.
What's that?
I played high school and college football. I didn't have to play 10 years of college football. I should.
Oh no! Not 10 years of college. Yeah, we know that. Yeah, yeah.
And
okay, let's clarify that. Yeah.
I'm making a joke. I'm making a joke out of that.
That is funny. That is actually
like
funny.
Animal House.
Like that.
You know, 7-year program.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That is hilarious.
But
you know, but that's exactly, you know, what I like to hear from somebody coming in with that great attitude, and we're going to get along just fine, because that's what we like to do here. You know, we want you to be and tell your story as compassionate as you want to be or need to be. And if you don't feel like that anything needs to be answered or wants to be answered, you don't have to. But I want you to feel comfortable, okay, because you're helping a lot of people out, including the host and the guest hosts, okay? We all need your help. So, you know, without, you know, any more of going back and forth between some information, I'd rather, you know, just tell us about your early days. I mean, the youngest you can remember, you know, growing up where you did, how your life was then, you know, maybe up until, you know, the time that it took for when you found out about your mom.
Well, I grew up, and I've talked about this, so, you know, it's much easier to talk about, and I'm a little long in the tooth now, but, you know, obviously when you first disclose, and I think the average disclosure time after incident is like 20 years for men. It takes about 20 years to get it, if they're able to get it out. And so, you know, this is something that's held deep inside. There's unfortunately a lot of shame that should be directed obviously at the perpetrator. We got to shift the shame. And, you know, so when you do, this is something that men and really men and women, but particularly men, have held so deep, because there's so many perceptions about it, which we hope to clarify.
No, that's correct.
And
absolutely
tonight.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into that extensively later. I would to talk more about that end of things later on, okay, because, yes, that's going to come up. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it needs to be said, because you're going to be that type a person to let us know, you know, what happened to you and how it went about, you know.
Right.
And that's what we want to hear, you know. So when you were a small child, you know, did you go to a Catholic school? Did you go to a public school, private?
Well, I grew up. I grew up in New Jersey in a town called Madison. It's about 20-25 miles west of Manhattan. It was a typical commuter town, suburbia. All right, our athletic conference was called the Suburban Conference at the time. And, okay. You know, there was a train that went right into Hoboken, New Jersey, and then you take either, at the time, a PATH train. Now you can take a ferry. A PATH is like a subway that goes underneath the Hudson River over to Manhattan. And, you know, going way back, I guess they had ships. It would be the train to the ships to Wall Street. And actually, I worked there in the summers during college, but I'll get to that later. I grew up in the town where my parents met. My parents met at Madison High School. My dad was a football player and a track athlete. My mom was a cheerleader and an athlete in various sports. She was also, you know, really, she was a student leader. I think she was student council president and, you know, was very involved in the community and embraced by the community. And my grandparents my maternal grandparents lived in Madison. So I was third generation and they lived five doors down from me. My my grandfather was a retired state trooper, and he was actually he was considerably older. He was actually hired by a guy named Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. To be in the first class. He was number 83 in the state trooper class of 1920 after coming back from combat duty in World War One. So, you know, I would spend my evenings, weekends. I remember my favorite cereal was Fruit Loops and with apple juice was my favorite meal. I'd be down on the weekend to sleep over with my grandparents. And, you know, I could walk down there. I had an older sister who's 4 years older than me. And, you know, she looked out for me. She doted on me. A lot of pictures from their yard, pictures from our yard. There were trees and things in the way, but you could see in a distance, we could actually see each other from, you know, our each other yards from our backyards. And so, you know, I was, you know, sense the real sense of community and safety and the athletic fields that the high school, before a new high school was built, were right next to, across the street from my grandparents. So that was sort of a intuited component of my childhood was that, you know, both my grandfathers were strong, very athletic, agile people. And, you know, so that was just sort of like the context that I grew up in. And then, you know, and I didn't know it was wrong, but, you know, I was very afraid from an early age to go out of the house, and I didn't know why exactly that was. And then, you know, in referencing and looking back on it, is that, you know, my dad went through a very rough childhood, and he didn't address it. It wasn't addressed. It wasn't to be addressed at that time. And so he had a lot of rage, a lot of anger.
You're telling me that you had a fright or some type of inside, you know, something scaring you for as young as you can remember?
I was very anxious. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I was very anxious. I started pulling my hair out when I was real little, and that created more tension. But, you know, school was like my safe haven. The kids loved me. I loved them. I have been. You know, I sort of inherited my dad's size and my mom's agility and her love of people. And so, you know, I was really well-liked in the school. And that was, it was, and I did, you know, athletically and in gym, I just loved it. And so,
let me ask you this too.
Yeah.
Is that, do you think that before we get to any type of abuse before that, which could be, you know, one sign of abuse, okay? How old can you put a finger on it as far as being maybe the first time that you were abused? Were you around that age, do you think? Five, six, seven,
I know I was physically abused, and there are pictures of it documenting it. I'm not sexually abused, physically abused. And it would come.
Right.
It was like Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just get a whack in the back of the head. And that's mm-hmm. how they would end. And mm-hmm. I mean a whack. So, you know, there are pictures of me with, you know, tears mm-hmm. in my eyes and everyone else is smiling or, you know, a
wow.
couple of people look upset. But I don't mm-hmm. really ever remember provoking anything other than having a lot mm-hmm. of laughter, you know. So that
yeah.
must have triggered
mm-hmm.
something in my dad
yeah.
that just went mm-hmm. off. So
that's
I
a very good point. It very well could have. You very well could have.
Yeah.
It's a good point. You know, we could talk about that later, too. So go ahead.
Yeah. But I think when that happens, you know, there's sort of like this duality. There's a sense
mm-hmm.
of love and devotion naturally all children have for their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was also a survivor. And, you know, she was I knew about it. It was kept very private, very secret. My dad was best looking in his senior class. My mom was most versatile and most, I guess, popular, I guess you might say.
Uh-huh.
And so they mm-hmm. had this ideal perspective or unit on the outside, but just like, you know, really unhealthy organizations, the appearances and the projections, like with Penn State, you know, is one thing, but what it's disguising can be just the opposite. And so,
mm-hmm.
You know, I just remember having really, you know, excelling and doing well, which I think is another sort of reflection of, you know, high achievement is often an effort by kids to be perfect so they don't get hammered at home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I did well, and then third grade came along. My mom had a mole on her back that was about an inch and a half to 2 inches long, and it looked like Long Island. And she went to the doctor, and we were with her. By this time, I had a younger brother. His name is – I'm not going to share the names, but my older sister's 5 years older than me. My younger brother's four my sister's 4 years older than me. My brother's
uh-huh.
5 years younger than me. And so we weren't –
younger than you are?
5 years younger.
Okay.
And so we weren't really in the same peer group. You know, I obviously loved them, and I was concerned for their well-being, but we weren't – you know, like a lot of siblings grow up and they're friends. And, I wouldn't say we're not friendly, but that we're just in different, like on different wavelengths.
Right.
And so, you know, different ages. So we didn't have that real closeness in addition
right.
to, you know, sort of like the fireworks that were going behind the scenes. My father did not touch my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
They were never abused by him. You know, so that was also... And I also noticed there was a trend when I was playing or giggling with my sister. That's when I would – that really fostered the fireworks. And so, you know, I became afraid of my sister in a way because of that.
Wow.
And so,
wow.
you know, because, like, every time I was around her, he'd go off.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know – and it was just because we were giggling.
Yeah, you basically
fun.
Just sitting there having fun, you know,
yeah.
doing things that you do as kids, and
right.
and you'd pay for that. You would make
yeah.
you pay for that.
Yeah.
That
and
is unbelievable.
And, you know, I think, and he probably regretted, I know he regretted what he
mm-hmm.
did to his mom. He's never apologized mm-hmm. for what he did to me.
Right.
And, I mean, this led to broken noses, you know, again, being hit
mm-hmm.
from behind, and then my face plummeting into a wall. Or a counter,
mm-hmm.
and so you know,
man, he would hit you that hard, huh?
Yeah, big man. He's
wow.
you know, well over 6 feet tall, well over 250 uh-huh. pounds.
Yeah, that is
so,
a big man. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that and I didn't even realize. You know, I just said, hey, man, everyone must be doing this. I'd go to my friend's
mm-hmm.
house, and it'd be very pleasant, but then I'd
right.
look around, and I'd be expecting
mm-hmm.
the shoe to drop. You know,
right.
and then sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and I think my mom did this intentionally, she shipped me off to friends to give me exposure to some families that, you know, she thought and she believed were
mm-hmm.
okay. And,
yeah.
you know, and so I did get a sense of wow, this is pretty nice. This is, mm-hmm. you know, this is real. Mm-hmm. This is good. So I did, right. It was a blessing that I mm-hmm. got exposure, and I saw that, yeah, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be this way.
Right.
And so in third grade, when my mom got diagnosed, my brother, sister, and I were all in the doctor's room when this doctor came in who had no bedside manner. He was about 80 years old. And he said, I'm sorry, but, you know, that looks like this melanoma. And if that's melanoma where it is on her flank, you know, you're looking at about a year. If it's actually, you're going to have to go in and biopsy. So my mom just like uh-huh. hit the floor. I remember I'm in mm-hmm. that room right now in Morristown, mm-hmm. New Jersey, where he said that.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom just mm-hmm. broke down. So I didn't really know what he said, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I knew it was bad. Mm-hmm. And so she did, she went in for a biopsy. Turns out she had stage 4 melanoma, which if you know about melanoma, that's a death sentence.
Oh, yeah.
It was in her, mm-hmm. in her liver. So that means it was in her lymph system. Stage 4 means it's in yep. her lymph system. And melanoma mm-hmm. is very, very aggressive. Mm-hmm. So
wow.
she had her lymph system removed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very athletic. Oh, no. She was petite. She had mm-hmm. One leg became, she had edema, extreme swelling because there was no filtering mm-hmm. of fluids
right.
for her legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember coming, you know, her coming home, and she was able to make my aunt's wedding, which was mm-hmm. you know, very a big surprise because she was able to get out of the hospital. But she had over 2,000 stitches, you know, coming up from her leg, around her back, around her flank,
mm-hmm.
that you know, was an attempt to get rid of all the melanoma. And so,
wow, 2,000, huh?
Yeah,
2,000. Oh my Lord.
Yeah, you know, there are different processes now.
Right.
I think, mm-hmm. you know, you don't have it such radical surgeries in this day and age.
Right.
But that
right.
was the main attempt. Mm-hmm. You know, and she obviously went, I don't remember at that time. I think she went through chemo and radiation. May not have mm-hmm. been as progressive, but it was a miracle. She lived for another 8 years till I was a senior
right.
in high school. And mm-hmm. then it, you know, she relapsed, and then you know, I'll talk about that a little bit later. But
okay.
But
well,
she,
listen, before we even go any further, I do want to hear more right after this part. You know, we've been in the show quite a few minutes now, and I know that you know, I'm sure you know Penelope and Kim are waiting, they're chomping at the bit, you know, so.
Yeah,
and they have a lot that they have to say about this too. I know they do because these are beautiful people. So, if you don't mind, Penelope, can I bring you in? You have any questions or comments for Matt?
Thank you, John. Oh yes, I do. And Matt, I just really wish to thank you for coming on and sharing what you've already shared with us. And I know. I've read your bio. I know you're very versed at public speaking and you've accomplished so much in your life, but I think every time we come on and tell our story, we experience some of that, and it's a gift and a sacrifice at the same time, and I just want to acknowledge that, and I really want to thank you
Thanks,
for coming
yeah.
on.
Thank you. I'll get into it, but, you know, what the first step is in recovery is, ideally with a trained professional in trauma is sharing the secrets, you know, and so, you know, it's still difficult no matter where you go, but I encourage people not, you know, you ideally want someone that's very well trained and perhaps ideally licensed in mental health counseling to share your, because they know how to respond to you effectively
yeah.
when you're sharing and disclosing. And I was blessed to have that at a young age. So I'll get into that later. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Do you have a question?
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so many things that you shared with us already, I'm kind of nodding my head saying, yes, yep, I understand. I was
yeah.
one of three. I was the mm-hmm. oldest. Now my siblings also experienced, you know, abuse, but I felt like for some reason, the lion's share of the my father's rage was really I was a recipient of it, and it, just in your story and saying that, you know, that you're the middle son, I was, you know, I could relate to that. I could empathize with that. And it also perplexed me a bit, especially with when you would interact with your sister. And it just sounds like that was a trigger for your dad. And I was wondering if you ever found out maybe why that was a trigger for him.
I really don't know. And he wouldn't acknowledge that but my sister would. She'll say, he never touched me, but boy, did he light in the mat. My God. And, she was older, so she knew. She, you're kids. She's not doing anything mischievous. She's just saying, if you know how to trigger somebody to get a reaction, you're going to get a reaction. So I would giggle or do something, and boom, all of a sudden we'd hear the big size 15 and a half shoes come running up the stairs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, boy, here it comes. Now,
yeah,
did you say you got the same treatment from your dad?
I did. My dad would just get triggered and he'd fly into a rage, or little things that kids do to get into trouble would elicit, a very there was a lot of what's the word I used? He wasn't just lack of integration, right? Just very dysregulated, but it was just. It's like the rage would come. I wouldn't, and it was, you knew it was coming. You could see it coming, even though it was a split second, and you knew that was it. And I think when you had said you would get hit in the back of the head and you wouldn't even see it coming, you would maybe hear it, you would sense it. To me, that is the fear to live in like landmines, that would also resonated with me of, not knowing, when you're going to step to the next one, and just the fear of not being able to control that. This is a very, very, very traumatic environment for a child to be living in that state of
that in and of itself. I mean, it's enough. I'm sure you guys are aware and have discussed the ACEs test, right? With Kaiser Permanente and the National Institute of Health, I think. And they have 10 behaviors or 10 incidents that are their childhood, acute childhood, adverse childhood experiences. And, I think I had 9 of the 10. If you have 4 out of the 10, your life is expected to drop to 60, your lifespan, because it just is overwhelming. And, you just don't learn the coping mechanisms because all those systems and structure supports that are supposed to be in place aren't there. So your capacity to identify danger is mixed. You have these mixed emotions with the person who's supposed to be a protector. And that's really why a majority of children that have come from abusive households are highly targeted. It doesn't mean it's a definite, but you're almost a predator can identify that. If you go back and look at all Sandusky's kids, they either wasn't a father present or the father was not present because he had been abusive in the household.
Yep.
So there wasn't that protection. I'm not saying a mother can't protect, but in general, she's going to have to be very strong and very diligent in the protection of her children if she's doing it on her own. And there are plenty that have done it, actually. But this, I'm just talking about what abuse in a household does in the grooming process. It allows, it sort of undefends a child. So they're much more vulnerable to outside abuse. And so, any other questions?
I did. So you did, mention that your father possibly there had been a, multi-generational cycle of abuse that you suspect or you have some that your father was abused as well, but it was something that was never addressed, and clearly that was a repeated, repeated behavior on his part. That cycle just continued. So you don't have to answer this question, but I saw your last name, and I was wondering if you were Greek.
No, it's a Lithuanian.
Oh, okay.
I'm Lithuanian. Like a lot of people ask me that.
In certain cultures, too,
Yeah.
We talk about things more openly now, but it was like we don't talk about these things, you know. We
right.
never talk about things, and we weren't allowed to break any silence, even within the home. There was this silence.
Well, I will.
Silence.
Yeah, it's debatable whether I was second or third generation in the United States. My great-grandfather came from Lithuania, and my grandfather was either born there and came here or was born in the United States. And, you know, they settled in New Jersey as well. And my great-grandfather was very, very driven, very successful. And, you know, so, and I remember just going, and I can hear his voice. You know, I had long discussions with him. I knew three sets of my great-grandparents at the point where I remember conversations with them. And, you know, that this was just, you know, maybe part of the culture. He helped build a Catholic church in the town he settled in New Jersey, and the social club, he built a bank, all, you know, from hard work. And, you know, that Catholic church is where a lot of us got christened or married. And, you know, just it was sort of like you didn't, you know, with the Catholic church, with the priests, you know, they're saying one thing, but they're doing something else. And so I'm not.
That's correct.
I think the Catholic Church has helped a lot of people, but it's hurt a lot of people too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think there are a lot of people that are survivors that remain and devoted, and they find great comfort from their faith. But that was sort of like a standard, was that this was sort of tolerated. This was part of life, you know, it being this tough, strong, dedicated and loyal, but when you have to be, you got to be strong. And then it just got mixed up that you had to be sort of nasty, which is actually a sign of weakness in the house. And so, you know, there were other things that, you know, went on, I guess, between my father and his father that, you know, weren't good. And it was probably related to his being first generation or first person in the United States, and the pressures and the stresses, and, you know, living up to your very successful father's expectations and all those things. But I'm just, you know, sort of guessing at this point. You know, I just remember the parties and the get-togethers, and there was a lot of festivity. But I remember having the tremendous anxiety. The other place was, obviously, we were in the back seat of a station wagon. And my sister would start, you know, and I'd start giggling. She'd make me laugh. Boom. You know, that one came, but I couldn't really see it because usually I'd be looking at it. It just would be that arm coming over the front of the seat. But when I was not in the car, it was always from behind.
So you never expected it.
So did your brother, was your brother targeted by your dad as well?
You know, my brother, I would say, I used to think before I, you know, went through the healing process that my brother was largely spared with the exception of a few incidences. But now what I've come to learn is that I think when your siblings observe the abuse, it's almost as impactful in terms of a trauma on the aid scale or more so.
I went
numb, you know. I went numb, and I completely left my body. So I didn't feel it, but they witnessed it, and they were helpless to do anything. So I have to learn that even though siblings were physically abused, not to the extent that I was, you know, they weren't. It's not Monopoly. You don't get the pass go for free, you know, when you live in that kind of a home and you grow up in it. You are affected. So,
it's just like a spousal abuse. You know, the kids may not see it directly, but they really do know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
All those vibes and energies are happening, and they have tremendous impact on people.
Exactly. And I know that we're probably going to hear this later on in the story, but, you know, I'm curious to know, you know, down the road, if how your siblings have done and if they have, you know, got through the healing process as well. Because by listening to you and obviously by seeing what you've accomplished, I mean, you just really have – broken the cycle and have helped and are helping so many people, which is so hopeful. You know, that's the light that comes from hearing your testimony and being able to understand and kind of walk there with you in our own, we're all in our own healing journeys. But I know this will come up later on the show. I am very curious to hear how they are doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're not close. You know, I think there's great concern for one another, but we don't talk. And, you know, so when my mom died, my dad got involved with a woman, you know, almost immediately that he ended up marrying. And that's sort of like, there was like, you know, just, it separated us further from one another. Mm-hmm. When something like that happens, either people, you know, sort of join together. I was at a stage in my life
right.
where I was a senior in high school, and then I was, you know, a recruited athlete, and I went to college. And so, you know, I sort of went out on my own, and, you know, you really get focused. I got to survive here. I got to work. I got to And, you know, I did not have a lot of models. You know, I'd visit my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles. They all had, my grandparents had a pretty rocky relationship, my dad's parents. But my other grandparents had a pretty nice relationship, and I think most of my aunts and uncles did. You know, and my friends who I'd visit, you know, they mostly had it, but there wasn't a lot of example of real respectful intimacy in our house. And that, you know, that led mm-hmm. to, you know, challenges in my own relationships with people, including my wife. You know, that you don't know why. And I've, you know, spent a lot of time with counselors, with therapists, trying to work through all that stuff. So, mm-hmm. you know, it sets you up on a trajectory where you're not seeing the healthiest examples. I'm not using it as an excuse. I'm just saying, if you don't have exposure to healthy models, you don't know anything else unless there's intervention.
That's exactly
of God.
Right. Yeah, you know? That's exactly right, Matt. Thank you so much for asking those and your comments and everything. Do you have anything else that you want to ask Matt tonight for right now?
I'll wait for the next one.
Because we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring Kim on. In just a second, I'm going to bring Kim on. Kim is also a part of the NASCA family, Matt. And before she comes on, I just wanted to tell everybody out there listening about our call-in number, okay? So it's area code 646-595-2118. And if you have a question or a comment and you want to call in and ask or have anything that you want to talk to Matt about, it's perfectly fine. We're here waiting on you. But furthermore, I'm going to bring Kim on, who is also a co-host with NASCA. Hi, Kim. How are you?
Hey, John. Thank you. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Kim.
Thank you for coming on and for being so open and vulnerable with your story. It's hard for me. I have, you know, such a heart for people who have gone through the same things I have. And I can mirror just about everything that you and Penelope were talking about. Penelope and I have bonded over many stories as well of our dads mm-hmm. abusing us, unfortunately. But I, you know, there were a few things that you had said that I just wanted to kind of touch base on and acknowledge, because of course, we didn't talk about it in our family either. I was the oldest, but then I kind of became the middle child because my uncle, who was 6 years older than me, moved in with us when I was about 6 years old. And so I had kind of both of those roles. It was odd.
Mm-hmm.
It was an odd feeling. But I had a lot of other trauma going on as well, personal trauma. I had my appendix had ruptured at that point, and I was also being sex abused by a neighbor. And so there was so much going on, and nobody was doing anything or talking about, you know, what was actually going on in the house.
Right.
And because they were all worried about everything else. And yeah, my dad, he worked in construction. And actually, it was my stepdad that he came into my life when I was 3. And then he
mm-hmm.
ended up adopting us. And so he was the only one that we knew, my brother and I. There were just 2 of us.
Right.
But he would come home from his job with the steel boots on, steel heel toed boots, you know, and would get me in the back, either my back or my butt. You know, and Penelope and I have talked about this many times, too, how that could have most definitely played a part into, you know, where we are at today. We both have back issues and have had several spine surgeries. So I was wondering if you had, I didn't mean to talk to you, Penelope, I'm sorry, but if you had, do you struggle with anything that has been physical as a result of all of your abuse?
Well, that's sort of, continue. That's a great lead. I will say, you know, I was an athlete. I was a three-sport athlete. And so, you know, the normal aches and pains that you get from that are there. But I will say that starting in fifth grade, I have a big head. I'm a big person, and I would get these muscle spasms in my neck that I couldn't move my body, and it had to be related to that, or either that or my body had to grow into my head. But you know, I remember those very, very painful experiences, and I never made the association till recently that it was probably in relationship to the trauma that was, you know, hit on it. I did have, in college, I lost after my first 2 years, I played offensive line, and defensive line. Then I played offensive line, and special teams in college. And, my fingers started going numb, and I had a very, my sleep disruption really started in college. And so I went to some specialists, and I had three or four vertebrae that were compressed. Now, I played football very actively since the time I was a freshman in high school, and I had played even earlier than that, but I outgrew the weight limit, so I couldn't play. But I'm not sure whether or not the compressions were related to the football, because we were very well coached, or whether it was related to trauma, or whether it was, you know, I fell out of a treehouse. Well, you know, who knows?
right.
But I've been, as far as that's concerned, I've been somewhat blessed. My body, most of my contemporaries that I played college and high school football with all now have replaced hips or knees. I'm all intact. You know, I do stretch, I yoga, I work out, I stay fit. Try to lose weight, but I've just readjusted it. You know, that's a hard thing to do. But I have not had those real physical challenges, the emotional challenges, the sleep disruption that went on for 20 years between the time I was like 18 or 17 to 37, you know, when I finally said, I can't raise my children unless I get this straightened out. You know, those are the things that sort of like the hidden things. And then I was diagnosed with hypertension when I was 30, despite being I had tryouts with the Pats and the Giants, and they, you know, I got inquiries from the Denver Broncos, and, you know, I was really excited about all that. And I've trained all my life, and I've always tried to stay in shape. And the doctor goes, what are you eating? And I was, you know, my cholesterol was off the charts and my heart rate was off the charts. And I go, well, you know, I work out about three or four times a week. And he goes, man, I don't know. So, I had hypertension. So I would have to definitely say that was from it. But, you know, those, again, are more hidden things right. that come up and sneak on you, just like abuses. If you were to see me when I was a kid or whatever, and that was probably another, to my detriment, you know, I was taught to create a very positive presence to the public. And, you know, I have a strong presence. And so, you know, people assume that I was probably the last person they would suspect was being, had all these other crazy things going on.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's always a lot of times there is that front that goes on. And it did in my family as well. My mom worked for judges. She was a paralegal. And so, you know, she knew what would happen if social services were called or something, you know, and so it was just very well. And she was, you know, unfortunately, she had been abused as well. And her mom had been, you know, it was a generational thing.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's a lot how it goes. Unless you make a decision like I did, I made a very conscious decision, even though I got pregnant at a young age, that I wasn't going to let that happen.
Yeah.
My mom had told me, it just happens, you know, abuse just happens. And you're like, at some point, and I loved when you were talking then about your friend's house, going over there and seeing such a contrast. And I remember that as well. And I think that that probably helps us a lot in
what's interesting too, though, is it, and you may experience this too, but you were very cued in. You know, you knew there were some houses too that there was some bad stuff going on, and you're on top of that as a kid. You're you know, your radar, you're hypervigilant, because you don't, you know, you're like, whoa, you're under this constant, and that's a lot of stress. That's a lot of stress on your body. So you can also cue in and tie in, at least, you know, I remember I had that, and I think a lot of kids that have abuse have that. They know, they're very aware of their surroundings, and, you know, who's on the up and up and who's not. And they can cultivate that, and it becomes a very strong sort of like intuition and protective system ultimately. But when it first happened, I don't know, do you guys have more questions, or you want me to sort of continue?
I'm going to bring in some stuff in just a second. I'm really interested to actually throw my comment in about this particular situation. Kim, do you have anything else for Matt?
No, I just wanted to mention the ACEs study. I love that study, and I've been, you know, kind of really excited to that a lot too. So,
yeah, it's very validating. It's a very interesting study.
It is.
Kaiser Permanente. Yeah. I think the original intent was to sort of address obesity in our United States, and they you know, interviewed all of these obese people, and the one common factor all of them had was sexual abuse. They were all sexually abused as kids. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, maybe there's something else going on here. It's not a behavioral thing. It's not a dietary thing. There's something else going on. And that's
Keep telling us about that, Matt. Keep telling us more about this, because I know there's a lot of listeners out there that really are interested in what this is about. So fill us in all the way through.
Well, I'm not an expert on ACEs, although I benefit from it. There are 10 statements, and if you go online and you plug in, it's Kaiser Permanente is the drug company that sort of spearheaded this assessment. And I think they were contacted by the National Institute of Health or the Center for Disease Control to do a study on obesity, to try to address obesity in our society. And I just know, you know, a lot of them, it was, you know, if you had abuse in the household, if a parent went to jail, if you were hit, if you witnessed your mother being hit, if you, you know, were sexually abused, those are like, I know those are five of them. There are some related to stability in the household, finances, you know, were you exposed to these things? You know, did you go hungry? Did you not know where you were going to go home? There are about 10 of these. And if you experienced them, you mark down, you know, yes. And then you give you an assessment of, you know, where you're at compared to the general population regarding your childhood experience.
Obviously they are jumping into a lot of things related to trauma and mental health issues. I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about tonight, and I can see what this is going to. And that's such a great thing, you know, for you to fill us in on that. So, yes. I want to get back to your story, too, now, because the last, you know, we left off was right after your mom, about, you know, the 2000 stitches and everything. And, you know, I'm definitely interested, you know, what happened, you know, with going into this, you know, horrific lifestyle of domestic violence. Why did it skyrocket all of a sudden?
Well, it was pretty steady. But, you know, my mom, when she got ill, I think it ramped up with my dad's stress. He was involved in the financial markets and, you know, just having to correlate with a huge recession in 73 with the oil embargo and everything. So, you know, he had a family, and it was very important for his family to be, you know, financially successful. So I think that was a major driver and identifier of success in life. And, you know, I was just, he'd already broken the target. I was an easy target. So, you know, anytime he did something, and I'll share with you a story specifically that outlines that. But, you know, so I'm going into fourth grade. I'm 9 years old. And my folks, my mom, I guess, went in for the surgeries that summer, came out, and then she had to go back in. And before she went back in, they took us on a trip throughout New England because that's where her father was from. He grew up on a farm, and we went up to his farm. We saw a barn that he helped build and the stone walls that he put up. This is a guy that became a state trooper. And, you know, it was basically, you know, there wasn't a lot of security and confidence in believing she was going to come back from the hospital. We didn't know that as kids, but, you know, that's why we all got pulled out of school for a week. So I went back, that's when my concentration started really sort of dipping. So I had these two major sort of real stressful situations. My explosive father, again, who, you know, I could see demonstrated was also a loving person to other family members and my friends. He was wonderful to my friends.
But
for some reason, I did something that triggered him about me. And so, or I didn't do anything. There was just something about me that was there. And so, again, when you have that, you're sort of groomed to find that in other people, you know, so you're going to surround yourself or identify or connect with people that are going to treat you that same way. So it's very important to break that and, be with people that treat you well. But anyhow, so that fall, then my mom, you know, after her second surgery, I guess she started hemorrhaging. I was in school and we just got a new puppy and I would come home. I was going to an elementary school that was about two blocks away from where we lived so I could come home for lunch. And my job was to walk the dog, so I'd come home. And so I'm pulling up to the house, and I see there's an ambulance in the driveway. Uh-huh. My grandparents' car is there. And I was like, oh, that's not good. Then as I approach the house, I see my father's there. And I'm like, oh, geez, what's going on? And I see they're putting my mom in the gurney. And my father just hands me the leash, and he says, here, take the dog. So I, walk the dog around the corner. And my mom gave him explicit instructions, do not drive past my son. But they didn't know which way I went. So sure enough, she, drove by me. And I remember the old ambulances, they were like hearses. They had a big window in the back. And she was sitting up, she was in the gurney. And and I remember locking eyes with her. I'm 9 years old. And
really?
He just
you remember
drove
locking eyes with her?
Yeah, and I just said, that's it. Wow. I could tell like she was sort of saying goodbye.
Oh,
and so
man.
Then I went back into the house, and my grandmother, bless her soul, my dad's mother, made me a – and she was a daughter of Lithuanian immigrants as well. She had made me a ham sandwich. And we always had ham with her, and I always ate like a peanut butter sandwich when I came home for lunch. And I wasn't being spoiled or anything. I just said, hey, Graham, can I even make a sandwich for myself? And boom, that was it. That
wow.
was fun. And that came to the back of my head, my face planted right in the plate, everything went flying, blood everywhere, and I went back to school.
Jesus.
Like that. And no one did anything. No one did anything until I came home that night, and my dad said, go over and tell our neighbor that we can't make their party tonight. My best friends was my next-door neighbor, and his parents, were very nice to me, and just as an aside, I lived in a mixed neighborhood in New Jersey. And, so my first friend was a different racial ethnicity than I was. We were very close. And I went over there and, I said, Dad, can't you call her on the phone? And he's like, you want to happen what happened today? And I'm like, oh, shit. So I ran over there and I started walking up. And she was tough. She was tough on my friend. She was always lovely to me, but she was tough on my buddy. And, she sees me coming up, and she was a nurse. She was a trained nurse. And I could see her whole disposition, her face just changed. And she hugged
me. She
knew. And it was like, wow. I was like, oh, my God. And I just broke down. I just broke down. Completely.
Did you?
And I thanked for it many times. I said, that was divine intervention, if anything. And I needed that more than anything at that time. So you never know. you know, you're not encouraged now in this day and age to touch other kids, right? But
right,
you never know.
Right.
The impact.
So how old were you? How old were you at that time exactly?
9 years old.
That's when it was. It was nine. Huh? Wow.
I was nine. So
unbelievable.
Then, so we have this neighborhood now that I think is very trusting and supportive because, you know, they're all helping out
mm-hmm.
because my mom's so sick. And we had a neighbor that started spending more and more time. My grandfather and I built a treehouse in the back. He was very handy, my dad's father. He sort of made up, I guess, with the transgressions of he and my grandmother got married very young and had my dad very young. And so I don't
mm-hmm.
think he, you know, he sort of regretted not offering my dad that kind of fun. So I, you know, he was more like a father figure to me. We'd make forts and go-karts and things like that together. And we built this treehouse. It was sort of like my safe haven. You know, I'd go out there, get
right.
the hell out of the house. And this scumbag neighbor started hanging around a lot, you know, and I just, you know, my mom was like, loved everybody. And we had this neighborhood that was supposed to be so safe. And the guy exploited me. It wasn't that year. It was the following. It was a total grooming process. And then, you know, abused me. First time he abused me sexually was in that treehouse that was my safe haven. And so, you know, then I really went away. And we talked about not knowing what's coming around. Often kids that are abused that have all
mm-hmm.
kinds of uncertainties around them develop OCD. And I had
mm-hmm.
that like wildfire, you know. I didn't have a clear thought from the time
mm-hmm.
I was about fifth grade till about eighth grade till after I got help and intervention. Ninth grade,
how
I'd
old,
have to say.
How old was the neighbor at the time?
The neighbor was over 5 years, 6 years older than me, 7 years older than me.
Uh-huh. Oh Lord. Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, I think that's you know, just a weird. Weird, just and the signal should have been there. That person was not in my peer group. You know, why is
right.
that guy hanging around? But my parents were, you know, they wanted to be everybody's friend. They didn't really know how to protect me. My mom did, but she was ill and she was being abused and she was, you know, had all these other things going on.
Mm-hmm.
My dad clearly didn't know how to protect me. And so, you know, I was very vulnerable. And, I think
do you know if he is still around, if he's alive, or do you know even know who it is?
I know who it is, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I do not follow up. I have no interest in knowing about this person
mm-hmm.
or where
uh-huh.
he is. You know,
I have a lot of interest in this because if there's a situation out here where he could be harming some other people, I want to make sure
yeah.
that he's supposed to be where he is.
I'm pretty sure he doesn't have exposure to other kids. I think he's like a city street dweller type of thing. That's the latest
oh, yeah.
I heard. I don't think he's a if he was at harm or you know, in a place where he'd be harming other people, I don't think, you know, I would
mm-hmm.
not tolerate that. But I haven't bothered. There was a our dean of our students had in Madison High School, didn't touch me, but he abused a lot of my peers. And he was back out in the school system, and we did some background work to
mm-hmm.
get him exposed. But, yeah, no, I know
right. mm-hmm.
I know enough
okay.
about this guy that I know he's
well,
not.
Good for you.
Yeah, I know.
Well, at least you
know.
That's good.
I know. I'm on that.
I'm going to tell you, here at NASCA, we, you know, we are definitely, you know, up on that in every aspect because we do not want anybody, you know, roaming the streets that could be hurting our kids or anyone else, you know,
no.
anymore. And that's what SCAN is all about. You know, that's
yep.
why we have a SCAN number tonight, which is 2783. And that
mm-hmm.
stands for Stop Child Abuse Now. You know,
yep.
it doesn't matter what kind of abuse it is. Just stop
yep.
it. You know, don't touch our kids. And you know, you're a prime example of what happened, you know. So your dad really took a lot of stuff out on you, I mean, for years and years. And I want to ask you this, is that I know we're going through, we got about 30 minutes left of the show, okay? So
okay.
I know there's so much that we never have enough time, Matt, you know, and you can always call back in and do another show because we need to know everything because everything you can tell us is helpful,
yeah.
okay, no matter what it is. But I also want you you know, about your book and everything else that's coming up, you know, to go on, you know, the one area that I wanted to ask you about real quick before you go into this, do you think that you took on any of that from your dad as far as being a bully in a way?
To my peers, to my siblings, to my friends, to my cousins, I became a protector. By the time I was in ninth grade, I was like 6'3", 200 pounds. Wow. I got this good intervention. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of committed. My mom was very concerned with me playing football because she thought that I would. Now,
wow.
If you asked anybody that I grew up with or anyone mm-hmm. I went to college with or anything, they'd probably describe me as the opposite mm-hmm. of a bully.
Yeah.
And
how big of a man are you now? Can I ask that?
Yeah, I'm about 6'4", about 270. And
welcome to NASCAR. You're definitely part of this family, big guy. I want absolutely, man.
I'd like that weight to be down, but it just doesn't want to go anywhere.
Well,
the doctor said, how much did you weigh when you were a senior in high school? I said, well, about 225, 230 at most. He goes, well, that's where you should be. I said, no, some people grow after high school. They really do. You fill out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I said, that's just not going to happen unless we amputate one of my legs. But anyhow.
Ahead.
I didn't. Now, in my family, my immediate family, I have a beautiful family. My wife, I have two daughters and a son, and none of it was ever repeated on them. Although my wife and I have had, you know, more spats than I think are appropriate, because because the triggering, I guess, you know, it's more fear. It's a trust-based thing, I think. When you're raised in a situation like that, you're not always sure who you can trust. And, you know, although, she's
that is a huge word for us here at NASCAR.
Yeah.
We talk about that all the time, man. I'm glad you brought it up. It really is. Mm-hmm.
And it's nothing on earth, but, you know, there aren't a lot of people in your life that get that close if you're blessed to be married and have a close relationship with someone. And if you've been abused or if you've been taught to create such appearances, you know, this person is with you 24 hours a day. They're going to see the inside. They're going to see all of you. And unless they're willing to go to counseling to sort of work through and very committed to the unit succeeding, it's not going to happen. Had I known more about the difficulty of marrying someone with a childhood like mine, you know, and I had all the, you know, hoops and whistles that, you know, would indicate that, yeah, this guy's a good catch. Right. I'm not saying I'm not, but I'm saying that there's a lot of baggage that comes with being abused as a kid, and you got to acknowledge
absolutely.
That.
I think we all can relate to that. And listen, while you're on that subject, and I think that a lot of us can relate to this because, you know, basically when you transcended, you know, from this bad childhood, okay, and then you moved on and you grew up and you went to college and everything else and things were changing for you, it looks like to me, through your life, and you became a leader.
I think what really happened was, you know, my mom finally was like, I don't know what to do. I was afraid to go to school. I was truant. My grades plummeted. Mm-hmm. You know, my scores were plummeting. And she's like, what has happened? And, you know, I just said, I have these things in my head all the time. I can't focus. I can't sleep. I can't. And it was all related. You know, I'm like setting up an internal protective system. That's what OCD is all about. It's like to distract you, but you're trying to control your world in some way because it's out of control. So I had these three major forces, the physical abuse, my mom's extreme illness, and, you know, the sexual abuse. And then you got to contend with everything else, going to school, you know, dealing with all the bullies or And I was a big kid with red hair and reddish blonde, actually. And so, and with a big voice. And so no one in my class ever would, you know, or even the class ahead of me would necessarily bully me. But guys 3, 4, 5 years older than me, I was like their size. So I, you know, but I'm like a kid, I'm, you know, and so I was targeted by those guys. So, you know, it was tough.
So did anybody else know about the abuse through these years?
No.
Nobody did, huh?
Other than, and this is where the transcendence happens. Seventh grade, my mom, I went to see a psychologist, and he gave me all kinds of tests. And, you know, I think they give you a lot of intelligence tests, and he made me take them twice because I think he thought I lucked out on the first time around. He'd heard such dismal reports on my, you know, academic current. When I was a kid, it was just great, but somehow I got three of these grades, you know. I don't know how I did it. And then, you know, I was able to share with him what was happening to me. And there weren't mandatory reporting rules then, but he helped me end that. And he also helped me end the abuse with my dad. And that was partly, I was too big to play football, but I could wrestle. And I was a heavyweight wrestler in eighth grade. And my dad said to me when I was like, you know, 13 or 14, he goes, I bet I could be a good wrestler. And he tried to start wrestling with me. And I just kicked his ass. And, you know, I was still maybe 30, 50 pounds lighter than him. But I just kicked his ass all over the floor.
Right, you had the technique on him, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like rocking him. And he goes, do you want to wrestle some more? And he goes, no, I'm good. I'm good. And his face was all red and everything.
Yeah.
And he never touched me ever again after that situation.
Really?
Yeah. And it both happened about the same time. Seventh, eighth grade, I stopped the abuse. I said, you touch me again, I'll kill you. And then I was able to stop my dad. So both those things happened. And, you know, I just thought it was an intervention of God, but I was finally able then to start concentrating and focusing.
Well,
that
is so, so great to hear. And look, listen, before you go any further, we have about 22 minutes left or so. I want to bring the panel back in for a minute, okay? Because we've been talking about a lot of stuff along the way. We still have a lot to talk about too, okay?
Right.
So let me bring Kim in first. Kim, you still with us, baby?
Yep. Yes, I'm here.
Ooh. Hi, Kim. You're on.
Hi. Well, I don't really have a whole lot of questions right now. I'm just you know, interested in hearing the rest of your story and just want to give you enough time to be able to finish what you want to say.
Good.
So thank you again, Matt, for being on and sharing your story.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank
I'll
you, Kim.
I'll
thank
bring
you so much, Okay. All right, Penelope, are you there?
Hey, John. Thank you.
There you are.
And Matt, I sent you a friend request as well. Let you know, a number of Penelopes are sending you friend requests today. That is me.
Okay, great.
So, yeah, you brought something up that I, you know, found, you know, compelling, and I wanted to revisit it, and that was you had mentioned you were, I think in high school or college, you're fit. You know, your slender build, you know, you're working out all the time, but you have this skyrocketing blood pressure.
That was when I was about 30 years old. Yeah, I started going.
30 years old.
I was
old.
About
and,
my late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah. And, you know, that is something that I think is, I just didn't bring it because it's really, to me, yeah, we all have family histories. You can't pick your parents when it comes to your genetics. But when you are a person that has lived from your childhood, your body's in this constant state of fight or flight. And that actually increases your insulin levels, which increases your, you know, insulin resistance, which increases your blood pressure and cholesterol. And so when you state, you know, people are fit and eat well, and there's really no reason for them to have this skyrocketing, you know, these risk factors like high blood pressure and cholesterol, you know, that is something to consider. And, you know, I can relate to that because here I was in my, you know, several years ago before I started the healing process, about 6, 7 years ago, and I'm, you know, slender, fit, never been in shape in my life, and eat. My cholesterol was so high, it was like I was going to have a heart attack any minute. It was just, you know,
well,
absolutely panicked.
Well, it's a silent killer.
It is. And it is also, I think, a symptom of a body being in a state of constant stress. And there are a lot of people walking around that are in this constant state of stress, especially if you have, like you said, you know, you're carrying unresolved trauma. You know, our bodies keep the score. So you brought it up, and I just think, you know, I was walking around. I hadn't gone through the healing process yet. You know, I couldn't figure it out. It wasn't until
You just referenced the title of Bessel van der Kolk's book.
Yeah, that's one of my
strongly. Hopefully, you guys recommended that to your audience.
Yeah.
But it's a great, great read, and it talks all about this. You know, how your body really internalizes and responds to extreme stress and trauma.
It does. It absolutely does. And so it absolutely does. So I love that book, and I'm actually a trauma-informed trained in the work that I do. So that book isn't a big part of training. But you brought it up, and I think people that, you know, there's still people walking around out there, as you know, that are, I think the average age is still in the mid-50s for the healing process to begin from childhood sexual abuse. I mean, you started much earlier. You were aware of it. So I think that these are just things that, you know, people may pique someone, you know, interest to, you know, hear what you just shared, and it may get them, you know, going in a different path with their journey or to start their journey. It might be that one piece of information that just, you know, hits home with someone. So thank you for mentioning that. And then I know
When I was a kid, it was like when I finally shared what was going on in the neighborhood, because it started, I was like, kid, and, you know, no one's really talking about sex, and, you know, we were more interested in just going out and building forts and having fun. But, you know, went on till I was like in seventh grade, and the kids would start talking about, you know, excuse the term, but fags, homosexuality. You know, I very masculine oriented community I lived in, you start wondering, I was like, what the hell is going, and you're trying to process, and my head's like full of OCD all the time, so I don't really know what's going on, but I'm making a good appearance to everybody as best I can. And, it's when I finally shared what was happening to me, it was like this huge weight just lifted right off my shoulders. And that's why it's so important to have someone. And his response was beautiful. It was like, you know, I was expecting him to jump across the table and say, "What? What's up?" It was just this calm sort of like acknowledgement and concern. Mm-hmm. And, and I think he may have asked me, do you want that to stop? And I think I asked him, does this make me a fag? And he goes, no, this has nothing to do with that. And I think that's an important factor I'd like to share, is that, you know, a lot of times people think homosexuals are natural predators. The two have nothing in common.
Nothing.
I will say this, just because you're homosexual doesn't mean you're not a predator. They fill the population just as readily as straight predators.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that, Matt. That is very true.
It has nothing, you know.
Absolutely.
Sex is an act between two consenting peer people from comparable peer groups. It's a mutually consensual act. And so, and so if the person is not in your, and even if they are in your peer group, a lot of times a bully mm-hmm. or a kid that has extreme power mm-hmm. or strength over another child
right.
in mm-hmm. their same age will do this, and it can have the same mm-hmm. profound effect. And so the other thing is then once you share those, he really tried to help me see that all the stuff in my head, you know, separate, you know, identify your cognitive distortions, things that you're either thinking mm-hmm. or not non-factual things, separate that from the facts, and then try to identify what behaviors am I associating with those cognitive distortions. Like I had a lot of repetitions in my life. You know, if I touched something and I was thinking of a bad person, I'd have to touch something and think of a good person. I had all these crazy things going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he started to help me see, you know, these just don't make sense. And the fact that I stopped the abuse was probably the greatest indicator. And these things just don't go away overnight. Because they're behaviors, they're patterns that start.
Exactly.
So you really have to,
yep.
you have to really decompress and rip them apart. And then you start making healthier choices and responses. And that's the key, actively making healthy responses to make healthier choices in every moment yep. that lead to healthier outcomes. And
well, that's
it was
exactly
like,
right, Matt.
Yeah.
You know, this is exactly what NASCA is all about. And
yep.
you just hit that right on the head, you know.
And the final one, not to interrupt, John, but I just
okay,
don't want
go
to
ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
The final thing is to do what you're doing is to surround yourself with healthier people. You know, usually, you know, you got to make that decision. You know, is this really a healthy – sometimes the healthiest thing to do is to walk away. And I work a lot with corporations now, bullying in corporations. And, you know, I have a very, very deep reason for wanting to stop bullying because, you know, I believe sexual abuse is the most vile form of bullying. It's not nothing about sex. It's all about power and control and trying to, you know, keep someone down that threatens you
mm-hmm.
and your own issues.
Right.
So,
now, listen, we have about a little over 10 minutes left. Penelope, okay. was there anything else that you wanted to add to that?
Oh, thank you, John. Well, no, Matt had mentioned too, you know, the marriage, being married, you know, coming into a marriage with unresolved childhood abuse, child sexual abuse, and
mm-hmm.
and I appreciate you mentioning that, and thank you for mentioning that. I think that
yeah.
you know, sometimes we find we're attracted to people that have our same history, whether we realize it or not, or there's some commonality
mm-hmm.
there.
Right.
And maybe
they're
we don't realize
replay, they're going to replay the abusive dynamics, the adult parent child, criticism, fear, power, control that
right.
that you experienced as a child.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
and
very
I
interesting.
Think,
yes,
yes. Yes, you know, in a marriage, if you know, one person initiates and starts the healing process, then, you know, that is a crossroads. You either both go in that direction and, or, you know, don't, I would say,
right.
just, some, yeah, don't let that hold you back.
Mm-hmm.
And it is
right.
a shift. It is a shift in marriage. And I just appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah. No, it's, it
That's
takes
awesome.
Two. It takes
it
two, although, you know, it's not really mm-hmm. fair, for a partner of someone who has that kind, then you know there's no real way of knowing,
right.
you know, if someone comes into a relationship like that didn't have a child, but most, you know, usually you get involved with people that have some sort of power control or abusive backgrounds, sort of draw, you know, are drawn to one another in one way or another, unless there's
mm-hmm.
a real effort to treat each other in an adult, mature, rational, objective, realistic perspective, it's gonna repeat that downward power and control, criticism, fear dynamic that happens
yep.
between you know, an unhealthy
oh yeah
critical
very,
parent
very
yeah.
unhealthy. You said the word. Yeah, unhealthy is what it is. Exactly.
Yeah,
you know, and too, Matt, you know, being a fellow athlete and a coach, you know, same with me. I've coached for many years, 15, and played
mm-hmm.
for 20, and you right there with me, okay? We know what it's like to be a part of a team, right?
Mm-hmm.
To really just focus, you know,
right.
and be a part of something and be dedicated. And this, you know, this has a lot to do with life. It has a lot to do with what we're talking about. what if you, you know, and this is what I want to ask you is, how did being a coach and a player come into play with also coming forward as a survivor? Okay.
Well,
when you did become a survivor, or even when you told your story, how did you feel after that? You know, because
well,
we just
exactly
finished
what,
with you. Okay.
No one knew about my, you know, everyone obviously knew about my mom's illness and death. That was a very public thing. She died. We were 9-0. I'm sorry. We were 8-0. And we were playing that Sunday before the game. We had a state playoff game the week before Thanksgiving. And I ended up being the only 3-year starter on 3 undefeated state championship New Jersey teams.
That's
and
great.
I was the, you know, we were ranked then end of the season 3rd, 2nd, and 1st in my respective sophomore, junior, and senior years. And I blocked for 3 separate all-state 1,000-yard running backs. So I guess my senior year, they're saying, well, who's been blocking for those guys?
Yeah.
We were 8-0, and that Sunday they said, Dad, you got to go up and say goodbye to Mom. So I went up, and she was really – she took a dive for the worst. And then she died that Tuesday, about 5 minutes after my sister arrived from Wyoming in the hospital. It was in hospital in New Jersey. So she was buried on Friday. We had the state championship game on Saturday, which we won. And we played against the only team that we were behind at halftime in the 33-game win streak that we had was that game, and we came back and won. And then on the next day, we had our SATs because that was the SAT day, and we had a special makeup. And then when I got the SATs back, you know, all my friends that I grew up with claimed that someone else took my SATs for me because they allowed me to get which they were busting my chops because they said, we know you. We've known you since you're not that smart. But they allowed me to be recruited by all the Ivy League schools and the service academies.
Wow.
I the first, you know, the Division I schools offered me scholarships as well, a lot of the big schools.
Yeah. I'm surprised Rutgers didn't offer you something.
Oh, they did. They did.
Yeah,
that was my dad's school, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, really?
They recruited me.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were. So, yeah, we had.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so that, I lost my train of thought.
Well, how did that, with being a coach, come into play?
So,
not only a coach,
so that,
but how did it come
being,
into play? Yeah.
Being a part of that team my senior year when my mom died, I mean, you know, that was like, this coach had an unbelievable impact on my life. And so then I went to college, and I had a very good playing experience at Brown, and became a teaching assistant. I love teaching. And a new staff came in my senior year, and they said, well, you're probably going to you know, this is probably not your last game. You're probably going to get a couple more years in being able to, but you're probably going to get paid for it. And I said, I'm all for that. And that didn't, and they go, but we think you'd be a really great coach.
Uh-huh.
And I go, And I just sort of fell in love with it, the whole idea. And I coached there for 2 years, and then that led to 2 wonderful experiences. And obviously I wasn't disclosing at that time. You know, no, everyone just knew me as a decent person who was a decent football player. And it led to 2 great graduate assistantship offerings, one with a guy named Don James at the University of Washington, Seattle, who was really a great mentor. Coaches, his most successful protege is Nick Saban at Alabama, and and then the other was at Penn State. Now my dad said, you know, we don't know anything about Don James because all the coaches on my staff, and many of whom had worked on the Penn State staff, told me to go work for Don James. You know, and I loved it out there. I loved him. I loved the whole scenario. I recruited the Northwest for Brown, and that's how I got to know him. And so. But I just had like a calling. It was a deep, deep drive. I left Wall Street opportunities, which I did in the summer when I was at Brown, to coach. And everyone says I needed my head examined for that. But I left. I just, you know, it changed my life. And I said, if I could do this with one or two guys in my life, my life would be worth it. My coach died last year.
That's awesome, man.
And I was one of the two people who he was 91. He lived a good life.
Oh, man.
And I was asked to, you know, I was one of two folks that was asked to eulogize him. So
oh,
that was
really,
probably
man? That
one
was
of my
great.
Biggest honors. Yeah.
What an honor.
Yeah. Coach
Absolutely.
Monica.
Yeah.
Ted Monica from Madison, New Jersey. But
okay.
So anyhow, so then I got down at Penn State, and it was a weird situation. I never saw anything. Those kids were always around, but it was just it soured me to coaching. It was about bullying. It was about, you know, Joe was
right.
not nice to me. I said, you know, this is a bunch of smokescreen and mirrors here, and I never saw the real deviants.
Right.
And then I decided to coach two more years at University of Rhode Island because it paid for my MBA, and then I started my consulting practice where I expanded the benefits of team and leadership to all different organizations. To help kids at risk overcome situations like I had when I was a kid. You know, that really sort of flourished, and I you know, was hired by a couple companies, and they, you know, kept growing and growing, and I ended up working for a couple clients. I designed a program at night, like an MBA program for Brown University, and I, you know, helped design, and I delivered that for 12 years. We had about 2,500 people go through. A lot of those people asked me to come in-house and do programs for them, and I did team-building programs down at the University of Rhode Island. Those customers, and again, I started all this with the intent of working with at-risk kids, but team building was the buzzword, and so corporations were really interested in that. That just led me to doing more and more consulting and working internally for huge corporations to build strong cultures. And in 1997, I don't know how much time we have left, but SI wrote an article. 2 minutes? All right, SI wrote an article.
Yeah, 3 minutes. Yeah, 3 minutes.
It was called "Who's Coaching Your Kids?" And on the front page of the cover were all pictures, you know, like jail pictures of all these pedophiles, perpetrators that were going from town to town as soccer coaches and molesting kids. And the parents were turned the other way because they were producing winning teams. And I said, and that's what, and that's, so that's 1987. I shared, 1997, I'm sorry. I shared my, I disclosed with my psychologist in 1975 and 1976. So it was almost right on the target of 22 years. I read that article, and I wrote a letter to my hometown saying, no one knew this about me, but I just want to say my coach saved me from this kind of thing, and that's what I got into coaching for. And this was this was about 14 years before the Penn State crisis hit the news. So then when the Penn State crisis hit the news, I said, holy cow, you know, I could have saved 26. I was there in 87 and 88.
Right.
Said, I could have saved, you know, 24 years of kids suffering had I been more aware and trusted my instincts more. I even smelled, if you're a survivor of childhood abuse, you can smell predators sometimes like a dog.
I agree with that. I totally agree with that.
And I'd like walked by him and I had that smell and I was like, no, I didn't. It was like cognitive dissonance.
You couldn't believe it. Yeah.
And
I can understand.
So anyhow, I went off then. I got contacted by the Washington Post, and, you know, I came out and I, you know, tried to talk to people about how they can identify and how they can respond and how they can prevent and then overcome all kinds of abuse. And then my life had really sort of evolved into helping people coming to me talking about horrific management practices. And so that was a natural fit. And as it turns out,
we have 1 minute left. I want you to give us the gem. What is it deepest of anything with your experience that you've been through in your life? What do you want to say to everybody out here at NASCA tonight?
Well, there's an amazing thing you can do or say to people. There are three. I mentioned my neighbors. Mom, who gave me the hug. Another time that I wanted to stay home from school, my dad actually stayed home from work and hid in a closet in case I was, you know, telling my mom I can't go to school. And he came out and he just ripped into me. It was like 10 minutes of throwing me around the room. I went into school, and the gym teacher walked by and saw me shaking and crying, and he came over and comforted me. And it was a lot like that my neighbor's mom did. And then lastly, I had a falling out with my father after my book was announced, and I met with my faculty advisor at Brown, and he's you know, I told him what happened. He goes, "Well, that's not love. Love is something that's kind and gentle and patient, and that's forgiving." And you know,
well,
that's
Matt, listen,
love.
I have to hang up.
Well,
I'm gonna have to hang up.
It.
We're out of time. Sorry. I want to thank you so much. Thank everybody in the world for joining us
love.
Tonight.
That's it. Love
that's
the
right.
Answer.
There it is.
Thank you.
You heard it.
Thank you.
You heard it right there. Love is the answer. Thank everybody.
All right.
Love you all.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Have a good
night. Good night. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt.
Okay. I'm going to end the episode. Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was